This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Diane Keaton has starred in a series of dramas and comedies that are now American classics, like The Godfather Trilogy and some of Woody Allen's most popular films, including the title role in Annie Hall. She won an Oscar for Best Actress in that film, and is up for another one this weekend for her leading role opposite Jack Nicholson in the romantic comedy Something's Gotta Give. Keaton's other films include Marvin's Room, First Wives Club, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Reds, and Father of the Bride. She directed the films Heaven and Unstrung Heroes. In Something's Gotta Give, Keaton earned her latest Oscar nomination by playing a woman whose daughter is dating a much older man, played by Jack Nicholson. Nicholson's character, Harry, has a heart attack, and Keaton's character, Erica, ends up being his host as he recuperates. This scene, which has them making pancakes together, hints at the unexpected but genuine attraction they're beginning to feel for one another.
You know what you're like? You're like one of those great portraits you see over a fireplace. Words have been invented to describe women like you.
Such as?
Flinty. And impervious.
So you think I'm inhuman?
No. I think you're formidable.
Yeah, cold, distant, like I'm frozen in some painting?
Not at all, but I do think that you use your strength to separate yourself from everyone. But it's thrilling when your defenses are down and you're not isolated. That, I believe, is your winning combo. Killer combo, actually.
You know, I can't decide if, oh God, if you hate me or if, you're like the only person who ever really got me.
I don't hate you.
Yeah.
Huh. Terry spoke with Diane Keaton in 1997, just as her film Marvin's Room was being released. That movie, too, had her playing a woman who was caring for an ill man. In that movie adaptation of the stage play, Keaton and Meryl Streep play sisters with opposite temperaments. Keaton plays Bessie, who has dedicated her life to taking care of her father ever since a stroke left him bedridden. Meryl Streep plays Lee, who has cut herself off from the family to establish an independent life. After Bessie is diagnosed with leukemia, Lee comes home to visit for the first time in many years, and Bessie confronts her.
Why can't you take Dad and Ruth?
I don't think so.
You can move down here. You can have the house.
No, I got Hank to think about.
He's very unhappy there.
Of course he's unhappy. If he were happy, he wouldn't be there.
You could have him transferred. You could find a very nice place for him here. You could have the whole house. You could have the sunshine. You could find work down here.
Lee? No.
Why not?
Just no.
Well, then give me one good
reason. Because I don't want to. I made this decision once already. When Daddy had his first stroke, I made this decision then. I was not going to waste my life.
You think I've wasted my life?
Of course not.
I can't imagine a better way to have spent my life.
Well, then we both made the right decision.
What decision? Dad got sick and I came down to help out for a little while. You didn't.
I had plans. I had a husband. I couldn't come down.
You didn't come down. And what makes you think for a second that I didn't have plans? You know, you're just the most...
Come on, say it. Say it. Say it. You've been saying it a million different ways since I first came down
here. Leave her alone. What are you yelling at her for?
She wants to tell you what a terrible person I am. I have been over backwards to be nice to you from the moment you walked in that door.
That's right. You are nice to me when you want something.
What are you talking about?
Oh, come on, Hank. You think your Aunt Bessie's being nice to you all of a sudden because she, what, felt an urge?
Shut up!
Oh, come on, what? Come on. Listen, did you ever get a birthday present from your Aunt Bessie?
I thought about you all the time. It's just...
How about a card? Did you ever get a card from your Aunt Bessie?
We were not close. We were...
You didn't speak to me for 20 years.
You're supposed to take care of your family.
I took care of my family. I raised two kids all by myself. Never even heard from you people. Now I am finally getting my life together. Nobody's going to take it away from me.
Your role in Marvin's Room is really the opposite of the kind of role we first got to know you from in your Woody Allen movies. Mm-hmm. Your character of Bessie is somebody who, first of all, dresses in very kind of Kmart-type fashions.
Literally.
Lives in a very sheltered world, is steadfast in her devotion to her family, mm-hmm. and has very little of a life outside of that. She's the kind of person who doesn't leave home, who's never mm-hmm. left home. Nothing is couched in irony. And many of your other characters, well, particularly in the Woody Allen movies, there's so many things that have quotation marks around them. And I guess I'm interested in what it's like to inhabit both of those worlds through your roles. You know, the character who doesn't live in a world of irony, and then the character who does.
It's easier for me to be in the world of the ironic because it sort of comes more naturally to me. I had trouble with this part regarding certain primary scenes, and I'm talking about the part of Bessie in Marvin's room. I would go up to the director and say, do you know that last scene? I don't know if you saw this, Terry, but the last scene where, well, obviously you did. You had to, probably. Anyway, the last scene.
I did,
I have
yeah.
to say to Meryl, I'm so lucky to have loved so much. I'm so lucky. You know, I really, literally couldn't say that because it's dead on, flat on, the truth, the feeling of the moment, the depth of that moment. And I remember the director saying, no, Diane, you have to say that. You have to say those lines. And I was going, no, because listen, let me tell you something. As far as I'm concerned, if somebody called me up, doctor called me up and said, guess what, nothing's working, and yeah, you are going to die. I couldn't sit there and get down on the floor and pick up those pills and say to my sister, I'm so lucky to have loved so much. I'm so lucky. I said, I would be terrified. No, that's not the intention. And because really, the heart of the piece is in that. You know, it's right there in those lines at the end there. And I was fighting it. And Meryl Streep came up into my room and she told me also in a very kind way that this is someplace I have to try and go and imagine. Of course, I can't imagine it. But on the other hand, you have to kind of get swept away. And one of the reasons I think that I was helped was, of course, because of Meryl, because somehow being and looking into Meryl's face, she just kind of lifted me up and helped me go there. But frankly, it's not easy for me. It's just not easy.
Tell me what was so difficult about saying I'm so lucky to have loved so much.
It's just so hard for me to imagine that someone says to you, you're going to die, and then 2 minutes later, you look at your sister and you say, I'm so grateful to have been able to love, instead of thinking, my God. I mean, I would be in a panic. I would be in a complete panic. I could cry with her, and like I could do the scene with her where I say, I'm afraid, you know, if I close my eyes, I'll never wake up. That I got. I mean, I get that, spades, you know, hands down. That's easy for me. But the other is hard to imagine being that kind of a person. I guess I'm shallow.
No, but let me ask you this. How do you decide with lines like that whether there's something that doesn't ring true about the script? Or whether it's just that you're a different kind of person than the character.
No, I think that it did ring true with the script. I think I did have to say those lines because I think that that's the kind of person she is at the core, that she can leave it and she can accept the fact that she's going to be leaving everybody permanently. So in that case, I really think as I was just begging for help, and I got help. I think that I'm afraid. I think I'm kind of a chicken actress, and I think that people really have to keep saying, you can do it, you can do it. And it really tells you. I mean, as an actress, it really informs me how much I desperately need a director who cares. It's so important to have somebody watching me. And lots of times it's easy for me to give up. And, you know, my tendency is to just kind of rush through everything. Like, I love to be fast. My favorite thing in life is to be speedy and quick and get through it. But I think they said no, and that was another thing that Jerry Zaks would say to me, take the moment, and I'd be going, oh, get out of here. You know, I mean, what is he talking about? He's nuts. I did take that moment. You know, I mean, you constantly are battling with yourself when you're acting in a part, at least I am, because it's just not that easy for me.
Yeah.
I think that I'm more inclined to live comfortably in the world of humor.
Diane Keaton, your mother was a beauty queen, yes?
No, here's what she was. Although she is very beautiful, by the way. No, she was Mrs. Los Angeles. That's entirely different. It means that when I was growing up in the 50s, yeah. We lived in Highland Park in Los Angeles. And I remember I was about 8 or 9, and my mother, became Mrs. Highland Park. And I remember sitting down in the stage and watching her being crowned Mrs. Highland Park. And it was that she was the perfect homemaker. I went to win Mrs. Highland Park. She kept making these chocolate cakes every day that we had to eat. And this was, you know, this was what she was. And then she went on to be Mrs. Los Angeles because she made a good spaghetti or something. I don't know. And they came around at like 7 in the morning, the judges, and looked at our house, which was insane to see if she was a neat homemaker. And so that was very exciting for about, I think it lasted for about 4 months. But then she made it to the finalists of Mrs. California, but then she didn't get Mrs. California. She was too good for him. She was too good for him.
What did she win when she won Mrs. Highland Park?
Oh, appliances. Oh, please. You know, just the best appliances ever and, you know, luggage and all those great things.
Did you want to be a happy homemaker?
No. No, I did not want to be a happy homemaker. Uh-uh. That did not appeal to me. But I did want to go on stage. I saw that that was something that did appeal to me. There she was in the theater, and I saw the curtain open, and there was my mother. And I thought, I think I like that for myself.
It's funny, so you kind of got the wrong message here.
I got the total wrong message.
She was,
how like life.
Yeah, she was presented as the picture of domesticity, and you interpreted that as show business.
Oh, yeah. Leave it to me.
One of your early roles was in Hair, and every profile I've read of you, every written profile...
Yeah, I didn't take off my clothes.
Exactly. Every profile mentions that during the nude scenes or nude scenes in Hair, that when everybody else was naked, you were wearing a body stocking. And I couldn't help but wonder if the cast...
No, I wasn't wearing a body stocking. No, no. The situation was that we were all under this huge tarp or something doing, you know, and we were lying there, and there would be holes in the tarp, and people would stand up at the appropriate moment. And you sort of just stand naked. That was how that was. And I just remember lying under the tarp and seeing all my friends get naked over the course of time. And I just didn't want to do it. It just didn't seem worth it to me at the time. I didn't want to do it. Standing naked in the dark and getting cold, you know, it just didn't seem like fun.
So
that's
had
the
it, had
only
it...
reason I didn't do it. It just, you know, it wasn't worth it.
So how did you avoid doing it?
I didn't. It wasn't a requirement by any means.
Oh, okay.
It was optional, and it was suggested, and you would get $50 extra.
No.
It's a money gig. It was a money gig. It's like everything else.
That's funny. So did anybody in the cast kind of make fun of the people who were not willing to take their clothes off?
Not really, but it was sort of get behind the spirit of it all. But, hey, frankly, I was, I had just graduated from the Neighborhood Playhouse, and I really wasn't a hippie. I never was a hippie. I was basically always an actress. And so I just didn't really get behind it in terms of the spirit of the moment. And besides that, we were all in show business. I never believed that it was like, you know, peace, love, and happiness.
Let's get back to our 1997 interview with Diane Keaton. But first, here's a scene from Annie Hall.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say it, you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
You want a lift?
Oh, why? You got a car?
You mean, no, I was going to take a cab.
Oh, no, I have a car.
You have a car? So, I don't understand. If you have a car, so then why did you say, do you have a car, like you wanted a lift?
I don't know. I wasn't... I got this VW out there. What a jerk, yeah. Would you like a lift?
Sure. Which way are you going?
Me? Downtown.
I'm going uptown.
Oh, well, you know, I'm going uptown, too.
No, wait, you just said you were going downtown.
Yeah, well, but I can...
I'm sorry.
I can go uptown, too. I live uptown, but what the hell? I mean, it'd be nice having company, you know? I mean, I hate driving alone.
Now, the inflections that you used in Annie Hall, a voice that's often speaking in irony, a voice that has a lot of insecurity in it as well as humor. How did you come up with that inflection?
Well, that I didn't even come up with it. I just delivered it. It was just there. I think that was something that he trusted and enjoyed. Did you happen to read that profile on him in the New Yorker?
No.
That was interesting because Diane Weiss was talking about him. And if something isn't working, he's very simple about why it isn't working. Well, with Annie Hall, when I was doing Annie Hall, everything seemed to be working. He just didn't question it. We were going with kind of the spontaneous impulses that we were feeling at the time in those scenes, and we just let it rip. I think Diane Weiss was saying, you know, in Bullets Over Broadway, when she won the Academy Award, that character wasn't happening, and he called her up, and he said, it's no good. And she didn't know what to do. She didn't know. And he said, he came up with an idea, and he said, I think it's your voice. Let's just lower it. Do you believe it? It's that simple. And then she had it. She had the character, and it was amazing. I mean, she's amazing anyway. But what I'm saying is it was a very simple solution to what a lot of people would have made a very complicated problem. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
He just cuts through all the time in every way.
Was your inflections in your voice in Annie Hall a voice that you really spoke in, or is it the voice of the character that you found, and what was your process of finding it?
No, I think I spoke in that character at that point in my life.
Oh, okay.
I think that's the way I talked.
Did you say la-di-da?
never did say that, though. That he wrote.
Was that on the page? I mean, if I saw la-di-da on the page, I think, oh, man, this is never going to work. And, of course, it really works terrifically. Did you think?
I think it's because it worked, because I think that there was this, it was the way we were working. In other words, it's how he directs, which is to loosen it up, just to loosen the whole thing up. And just fly with it. And then it worked. I know, that doesn't seem like a very good line, does it? La-di-da.
Well, it wouldn't to me on the page. It really
no.
would not.
Mm-mm.
But it does in the movie.
It worked, yeah.
Now, I want to ask you about the Godfather movies. You're in all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in particularly in the first two movies, you're the woman in a world of men. And
I mean, it's such a funny. Yes, I was. I was the woman in a world of men.
And that's really brought home at the end of the first Godfather movie where Al Pacino,
that's a great moment,
yeah,
isn't it?
Slams the door in your face and makes it really clear that now that he's the head of the family,
he's the head,
you're going to be shut out of a lot of his life.
Oh, it's a world I know nothing about. Do you know, when we were making it, it was just, I didn't know what was going on, and I just did feel left out. I really felt that way. And I also felt, I never understood why he cast me in that, ever. I still don't understand why he cast me in that. I never thought, you know, at that point in my life, people viewed me as being kind of kooky. You know, I was like the kooky actress. And he cast me in that role.
Right.
So you're serious.
Yes, and sensible, down to earth, practical.
I'm telling you, it's nothing. I never got it. And he never, I don't know what made him pick me. That was a lucky break.
What was your audition?
Because I'm really glad to be part of that, those movies.
Oh,
I'm proud to be part of it.
I can only imagine how much. Yeah.
Yeah, but they were a mystery to me. They still are a mystery to me. That's a world I really don't understand. I do understand what she was like, feeling left out.
Mm-hmm.
No one likes that. That's a horrible thing. It's a cold thing.
So in what ways did you feel maybe kind of left out or the outsider on the Godfather sets?
I think in every way I felt the outsider. There was nobody that really became my friend on those movies. I guess I really...
What about Al Pacino, though? You had a relationship with him.
But not as... I mean, it wasn't like we palled out.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't... Do you know what I mean? He was very private and separate from me. And in the first one, I really didn't know him very well. And I think he was also overwhelmed by the enormity of his part. And he was so... profoundly, I think, great in that movie. I think when he has to murder for the first time, I think that's a very amazing performance he gave.
Mm-hmm.
So he was really a loner. He was really involved with that part. He was separate from the other guys, I felt. And he was in the movie, too. But I just didn't know what the hell was going on. I was, 23? I didn't know anything about movies. I was overwhelmed by the entire enterprise. I really was.
You said you had no idea why Coppola gave you the part. What was your audition like? What had he seen of you?
I don't know. I have no idea. I came in, I auditioned like everybody else. I don't know what it was that he saw in me to cast me instead of Jill Clayburgh. Or whoever else was up. I remember she was up for it. And she and I were kind of similar at that time. We were sort of, you know, together up for the same parts and things like that. I don't know. I really don't know. I think Michelle Phillips was up for it. I think, who else was up for it? I don't know.
All the gals
at that time, I'm sure, were up for that part.
I'll change. I've learned that I have the strength to change. And you'll forget about this miscarriage? and we'll have another child, and we'll go on. You and I. We'll go on.
Oh, Michael. Michael, you are blind. It wasn't a miscarriage. It was an abortion. An abortion, Michael. Just like our marriage is an abortion. Something that's unholy and evil. I didn't want your son, Michael. I wouldn't bring another one of your sons into this world. It was an abortion, Michael. It was a son, and I had it killed because this must all end. I know now that it's over. I knew it then. There would be no way, Michael, no way you could ever forgive me. Not with this Sicilian thing that's been going on for 2,000 years.
Claire! You won't take my children.
I will.
You won't take my children!
You're my
children. Diane Keaton speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. Keaton is up for an Academy Award for her role in the film Something's Gotta Give.